There's evil in the world, isn't there? This is one of the, this is what's known as the Epicurean argument. It's the favorite argument of unbelievers, atheists, agnostics, for why they will claim that for the basis of why they reject a belief in God. We'll very often see that brought up. Well, if there's evil and there's suffering in the world, and if there was a God and a good God, then that wouldn't be so. Well, that's what they think, but that's wrong. The fact that God has made us in His image and put us on this earth with the purpose that God has for us to choose to serve Him as our Maker. As soon as we're given a choice, as soon as God gives us a choice whether to serve Him or not, what happens when somebody chooses not to? What are they going to be doing? Evil. So the only way that God could have prevented any evil from existing in the world would be what? To not allow there to be any temptation to do evil. And without that, then are we willingly choosing to serve God then? We wouldn't be. But that's God's desire for us to choose that. So necessarily that means there has to be temptation. There has to be a source of it. There has to be evil. That doesn't mean God approves of evil. But that's going to be the result of the choice not to serve God. And furthermore, whenever someone chooses to do evil, then how often is it going to be that someone's choice not to serve God is not going to in some way hurt someone else? How often can we do wrong with there being no consequences on any other people or beings? Yeah. Virtually never. You're right. It's almost impossible to do something. I suppose we can have some evil thoughts, perhaps, that if it stays there and goes no further, then we could be guilty of sinning with our thoughts but not carry forth into any action to hurt someone. But, it's a pretty rare thing for someone to, because very often what happens with evil thoughts, what do they end up getting translated into? Actions, words and actions. So it's pretty rare that evil is confined within just one individual. That is the whole point of the law of the prophets. What's the greatest commandment? That's right. And the second is like unto it, love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two laws hang all the law, all the law and prophets hang on those two commandments. So everything else follows from those two basic commands, loving God and loving one another. So as soon as one does not do that, again, when we choose not to love God and obey Him, then we're going to be transgressing against Him, but then that's also going to follow suit, that we're going to not be loving other people and that we're going to end up doing some harm to them. In Romans chapter 13, for example, let's say we can turn over there for a moment, and he's going to quote many of the Ten Commandments here, as this is one of these passages where we see application or carryover of commandments that were in the Old Law made part of the New Testament, part of the Law of Christ, which makes sense as he's going to show us here. Those two great commands that we have that God gave in the Old Testament, they themselves are a part of the New Testament. Well, why wouldn't they be? The greatest commandment is still to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. We still need to love one another. Of course, we even have a higher standard for us to love one another as Christ has loved us, the new commandment. But still, when we read in Romans chapter 13, he's going to bring that up and make this point very strongly about loving one another and that being displayed or demonstrated by our keeping these commandments of God. Verses 9 and 10, if we can read that in Romans chapter 13, Brother Glenn.
This, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law.
So, to work ill with someone is certainly not loving them. And those commandments that he names in verse 9, all of them part of the Ten Commandments from the Old Testament, do they, if you break one of those commandments, are you going to be working ill to your neighbor? Every one of them. And that's the point. So to fulfill God's law, if we're going to love him, we got to love others. And that means we got to keep those commandments and not do those things. Of course, they're the things we have to do from the positive standpoint. But again, it just shows that when doing evil is going to hurt others. That's going to be a natural offshoot or consequence of our having a choice to serve God. As soon as we don't, we're not only sinning against God, but we're going to be hurting other people by doing evil to them, affecting them by our wrong choices. And God obviously does not approve of that. And so even though it's God's will for that choice to be there, which is going to mean there's evil in the world, and that's one of the things that those who would make the argument about against the existence of God on that basis, they don't understand this. They also don't understand that for those who are serving God, God will take the evil that is there and the suffering that is there for us, and he's going to work it for our good, as promised in Romans 8:28. So God's going to use that to help us to grow in the image of Christ. So God will have a good purpose for those things. So even the things the devil is doing, God's going to turn that to his to fulfill his will, well, in punishing the wicked, but also in strengthening his children, the righteous. So that's where all of that that argument breaks down and is exposed as false. But here in Isaiah chapter 10, if we can go there, we see an example of this as he's going to be speaking of the Assyrian king, and this would be Sennacherib, the one that actually carried this out. God was going to be using the Assyrians to punish the children of Israel, which he did with the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, the two kingdoms that we're reading about now in our study of first and second Kings and second Chronicles. We'll get to the end of it with the northern kingdom brought to its end by the Assyrians. We mentioned last week about that 19th and final king of the northern kingdom, Hoshea. All of those kings continued in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. And God ultimately used the Assyrians to bring an end to that kingdom and those tribes. There was nothing good left there. So God destroyed them. And there was a remnant carried into captivity, dispersed by the Assyrians. They were not brought back to Israel because they were fully assimilated into the world spiritually and then became so physically, and they became known as the lost tribes of Israel to history. They were gone for forever. Judah remained by itself with the tribe of Benjamin, and then also the remnant of those other tribes who had migrated out of the northern kingdom, which we saw part of that during the reign of Rehoboam in his first 3 years, and then we saw again another influx during Asa's reign. But those ones that came from those other tribes down to join themselves to Judah because that's where they could serve the Lord. There were remnants of those tribes that remained or persisted, which is why we read about some of those even to the New Testament time that were from other tribes other than Judah. But the vast majority of the Jews that remained after the northern kingdom was destroyed were from the tribe of Judah, and that's why they became known as what? Practitioners of the Old Testament religion. What do we call them today? Jews. Well, why do they have that name? Short for Judah. They're the tribe of most of them. But anyway, God punished them using the Assyrians, first the northern kingdom, taking them out of existence, but he also used the Assyrians at the same time. They invaded Judah. and took all their fenced cities. This was under the reign of Hezekiah, who was the contemporary of Hoshea and outlasted Hoshea. Hezekiah was righteous, and because of that, God saved him and Jerusalem, but the Assyrians came through and then had Jerusalem surrounded, and that's all that was left. They were down to their capital city surrounded by the Assyrians, and that's when God sent his angel into their camp and killed 185,000 of their soldiers in one night, and they fled back to out of Israel to Assyria. But God was foretelling this destruction and how he was going to use the Assyrians to do that in Isaiah chapter 10. But he also shows that he was not approving of the instrument that he was going to use to do that. Now, does God make anyone do evil? James 1:13 says he cannot be tempted with evil, neither does he tempt anyone with evil. When we read in Genesis 22:1 where it says that God tempted Abraham, that word is test. He gave Abraham a test. Did God try to entice Abraham? Was God trying to get Abraham to disobey him when he commanded him to offer his son Isaac? Of course not. God was encouraging him to obey, and Abraham did. Now, who was the one tempting him to not obey God, to not believe God and his promises, and then therefore not offer his son? Well, of course, that would be the devil. And then it was God's will for that not to be carried forth to the final act. Abraham was, about to do it, and God stopped him. We're told in Hebrews 11 that Abraham was considering in his mind, well, God made the promise, that meant God was going to fulfill it, so he would raise Isaac from the dead and then fulfill it. An incredible faith that Abraham had. When God told him to do something, he was going to obey it. But God does give us tests, but in the test, God's role is encouraging us to have faith and obey, not to disobey. It's the devil in that test that's tempting us to do evil, to disobey God's commandments. So that's the role of it. I mean, the very short summary of the role of the evil, but it's God's will that those things happen. But God is not going to entice anyone to do evil. He's not going to tempt anyone to do evil. And so when there's evil to be done, who's going to be behind it? Well, that'll be the devil. And does the devil have? Is there a short supply of people that are willing to do evil so that the devil is looking around, well, here's all this evil I want to do, and God will even let me do this, but I just don't have anybody to use to do it? Has that ever happened? Never happened, and it never will. I mean, the devil is has a very rich supply of people that are willing to do really anything. In actuality, what do we read in scriptures? It's not that there's a lack of those that the devil could use or opportunities or things that the devil could do and would do. It's God having to put the brakes or the limits on that. God does not allow us to be tempted above what we can bear, as he tells us in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. It's God that's going to provide a way of escape from temptation for us at every time. So God's the one putting limits on Satan. You remember that Peter, the Apostle Peter, was told by Christ before he denied him when he was saying, I will die for you. And Jesus told him, he said, Satan desires to sift you as wheat. And he said he was praying that for him in that. Well, what is Satan's desire to do to us? I mean, what did he desire? And what did he desire to do to Job? Is Satan able to operate and do whatever he wants in this world? No. God is in control, and God will allow things to happen within whatever is going to suit God's purposes. But God puts those limits there. I mean, Satan was complaining about that God had a hedge, a fence around Job. But God allowed Satan to go a certain extent, but no further. And so he kept the limits there, as he always does. Brother Jan?
Satan's putting there, right? Right? So
yes.
Vessels like Sennacherib, they've made that choice to go after these desires and give into those desires rather than pulling themselves off from those desires.
I mean, Sennacherib is not going to be over here saying, I really hate to do this. I hate to invade this other country, but since they're wicked, I guess I'm going to have to go over there and take it out on them. I mean, that's not what he's doing, and that's not what others like him would do. That's not what Baasha was doing, which is the point where we're going with all this. I mean, it was not like Baasha's. You know, I really kind of like Nadab and Jeroboam's family. They're pretty cool people, but they've been really bad, so I guess I'm going to have to do this. I mean, that's not what Baasha was. That's not how he was looking at that. Nor was it he was being good and God said, "Go do this anyway." No, this was going to involve murder. It was going to require some awful deeds. Devil was certainly willing to do it, but so was Baasha. Just like Sennacherib, what we're going to read about. It's very clear in the description here in Isaiah 10. If we'll ever get to it. Well, let's go ahead and read, starting in verse 5, just to kind of set the table. This is what was going on. But God was going to have to punish his people for their wickedness, and he was going to use a willing tool in Sennacherib and these Assyrians to do that. And we will see the willingness of the Assyrians to do what they were going to do. And let's go ahead and read verses 5 through 5 through 11. Let's see. But Jacob, can you read that? Isaiah 10, 5 through 11.
Woe is to the God of my anger, and the staff of my hand is mine in division. I will send him against and hypocritical nation against the people of my wrath, for I give him a charge to take the spoil.
Yep.
Is not Haman as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus? As my hand has found kingdoms of idols and whose great images did excel them from of Jerusalem and of Samaria, shall I not, and I have done to Samaria and idols, so to Jerusalem and Christ.
And it's clear that this is what he's saying after he's been used by the Lord to punish the northern kingdom, Samaria, that was full of idols. But God was going to use that nation to bring punishment on Judah for her idolatry. Hezekiah was righteous, prayed to the Lord, and the people joined him in that. And so there was a repentance on the part of the people. And God spared Jerusalem for that reason. But they suffered a lot up to that point that he's foretelling here. But he refers to the Assyrians in verse 5 as the rod of God's anger. And the staff that was in their hand was God's indignation. So God was the one carrying this out. He was the one working through the Assyrians to punish his people for their iniquities. He was going to pour out his anger upon them. But what does it say in verse 7 about the Assyrians? It is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. So was God forcing someone to do something they didn't want to do? No, he was. Did Sennacherib and the Assyrians, did they have a desire to conquer? They had a lust for conquering. And they were looking to cut off many nations. And we see the boast on the part of the Assyrians there and all these places that they had conquered. And are you any better than those places? And they fell. You're going to fall too. Those are the words there. But what did God say in the end was going to happen to the Assyrians themselves after God was through using the Assyrians as an instrument of his anger and punishment against the wickedness of his own people? Well, that's where verses 12 through 15 come in. Brother Tom, can you read that, Isaiah 10, 12 through 15?
Wherefore shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Sarah, and the glory of his high looks. For he said, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent, and I have removed the bounds of the people, and have brought their treasure. And I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man, and my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the people, and as one gathereth eggs that are left. Have I gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved the wind, or opened the mouth, or peeped? Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it? As if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or as if the staff should lift itself up, shall lift up itself as if it were no wood.
So what was the role of the Assyrians here? A tool in God's hand. Who was operating the tool? God was. But who was boasting against the maker and the user thereof? The tool. But how foolish is that? But then what is God promising to do to the tool? He was going to punish Assyria. Tom, do you have further comment on that?
It sounds like there are vessels for dishonor, as there are vessels of honor.
Yes, and that's exactly what we're reading about. So we had, in this case, we had Israel and Judah, and God used Assyria as punishment there. Then he said he was going to punish the Assyrians. Who did he ultimately use to do that? And not just Assyria, but all these other nations. Well, if we turn to Jeremiah chapter 25, and I wish we had time to read this whole chapter, because it goes through listing all of the nations that were on that were going to be drinking, and this is where God uses the descriptive term multiple times in here. They were going to drink of the cup of God's wrath and indignation, and he's going to go through and name all these nations that were going to be drinking from the cup. Well, who was the one that he was going to use to make them drink? Which he also used to destroy Assyria. Of course, Assyria completely took out Israel, punished Judah, but Judah was still around. But then we have this other nation that's going to come on the scene that God was going to use against Assyria. And they were going to be wiped out. It was Babylon. So God's going to, that's what Jeremiah 25 is all about. We just want to look at a couple of the verses here, though, where the point is made. Verses 11 and 12, this is where he's applying it to, particularly to Judah, and foretelling their destruction and the captivity in Babylon. Now, he was going to preserve a remnant over there and then bring them back after 70 years, but he's foretelling that in Jeremiah 25, 11 and 12. Brother Ted, can you read that?
This whole man shall be a desolation and a abomination, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon, and it shall come to death in 70 years, and accomplish that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, says the Lord, and their iniquities, and the land of their dearest, and will make it pestilent desolation.
Okay, so he was going to use Babylonians as the instrument of his wrath there, but what did he say he was going to do to Babylon after that was over? He was going to make them a desolation. Who was he going to use to do that? The Medes and Persians. If we had time, we could go to chapter 51 where he's foretelling that. So we had Persia that he then used against them. But later Persia was going to get punished. I mean, this is what would happen. I mean, God would use a certain one. That meant that for God to use the Assyrians to punish Judah and Israel, did that mean that the Assyrians were righteous? No. They were willing to do it, and God used it to get his work done. Well, did it mean the Babylonians were righteous when he used them to punish the Assyrians for their wickedness? They were doing wickedly in their, and God used that for punishment. But he did the same thing with Babylon, judged them. I mean, that's the pattern. This is what's going on a smaller scale here in 1 Kings chapter 16, where, well, instead of nations like Israel and Judah, we have Jeroboam and his family. And instead of Assyria, and here we have Baasha. But it's the same thing. And God is using Baasha as a tool in his hand to do that. But when Baasha's doing the same thing that the one was doing that he's punishing, using Baasha, then he's going to use somebody else to punish Baasha and judge him for that. And what's going to happen to the one that did that? And that's really what 1 Kings 16 is all about. I mean, the essence of it. We're going to see a series of this, but it's God punishing all of these wicked people, but using other wicked ones to punish those wicked ones who punished the wicked ones before them. So it's the same pattern here, but we see it on a multiplied several times, but here on the scale really dealing with the ruling families. Can't even call it a dynasty because none of them last, other than when they're with a couple of cases like Nadab, who has a 1 year actual reign as a successor to his father Jeroboam. And we'll see the same thing with Elah, the one that was Baasha's son, but he's going to have a very brief reign too before Tirzah gets him. But this is what's going on, so we can understand. It doesn't mean that God's approving of what Baasha did and the evil that he did, and God is in fact going to punish Baasha for his own evil, and then the one that does that to him as well. So back to 1 Kings 16, hopefully this will help us to understand what God is actually doing, the overall work that God's accomplishing here in this chapter. And so what did God say he was going to do to Baasha? For his own sins. Well, that's in 1 Kings 16, 3 and 4 that we read, when he said he was going to take away the posterity. That's not prosperity, that's posterity. Well, he did both. Whatever prosperity he had, he lost that too, but he lost his posterity, his descendants, his family. And he says he was going to make Baasha's house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. And whoever died of Baasha in the city, the dogs would eat. If they died in the field, the birds of the air would eat. Same words that he used against Jeroboam and that Baasha helped to carry out. And so we got to verse 5. The rest of his acts and what he did and his might, are they not written in the books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? All right, so then Baasha dies in verse 6, and his son Elah is going to take over. So now we need to read what happens to his son and the rest of his family. Let's read verses 6 through 14 here in 1 Kings chapter 16, 6 through 14. Let's see, Brother Aaron, can you read that for us, please?
Baasha slept with his fathers. When he married Tirzah, Elah his son reigned in his stead. Also by the hand of the prophet Nathan, the son of Hanani, came the word of the Lord against Baasha, against his house, even for all the evil that he did in the sight of the Lord, and provoked him to anger with the work of his hands, and did not like the house of Jeroboam because he killed him. In the 20th, 6th year of Asa, king of Judah, had Elah the son of Baasha,
Okay, so Baasha died, and this is following exactly the pattern with Jeroboam. Did Jeroboam die a violent death? He didn't. Did Baasha die a violent death? Well, he didn't either. They both completed their reigns of several years. But as soon as they died, when their sons came in, that's when God brought it to pass. That's what we saw in chapter 15. As soon as Nadab became king after 1 year, that's when Baasha killed him and all the rest of the family. Well, here it's the same exact pattern. Same thing happens. Baasha dies. He's buried. And then Elah becomes king, his son. And then God brings the punishment on Baasha's house directly upon Elah and all the rest that remained. I mean, God could have certainly cut Jeroboam's own days short and Baasha's and brought it directly on them. He chose, for his reasons, he chose to wait until after they died, but then shortly after that, that's when it was brought to pass. So in verse 7, plainly, it goes back to Jehu, the prophet that we were reading about at the beginning of the chapter, the son of Hanani, and what he said. So he mentions him specifically that by the hand of Jehu, those words were pronounced. God's word was pronounced against him, and then it was brought to pass. So what does that tell us about Jehu, the son of Hanani? What does that tell us about the kind of prophet he was? A true one. He was God's prophet. It was God's word. And God is proving it by bringing to pass what he said and fulfilling it exactly with 100%. So Jehu prophesied it because it was the word of the Lord, as it says again in verse 7, against Baasha. It wasn't Jehu's word, it was God's. And he gives the reason in verse 7. And how many reasons do we see that he gives for doing this to Baasha's family? With Jeroboam, it was one big reason, because of all his sins and wherewith he made Israel to sin. So he did all those evil things. And he drove, as we saw that point, he drove Israel away from the Lord. He was being a stumbling block to the whole nation, to all those tribes. He was preventing them from serving God and actively pushing them to do evil, commanding them to do it, forbidding them from doing what the Lord commanded. And that's why he was destroyed. Well, what does it say about Baasha there in verse 7? He did that also. He did evil in the sight of the Lord in provoking him to anger with the work of his hands in being like the house of Jeroboam. But then he also adds in a second thing, doesn't he, at the very end? And because he killed him. So that's one thing that Jeroboam didn't murder Solomon to become king. Not that he wouldn't have been willing to do it, but he didn't. And he didn't murder Jeroboam, or Rehoboam rather. Again, not that he wouldn't have been willing to do it. They fought. But the fact is, that didn't happen. Obviously, it wasn't God's will. But Baasha did kill Jeroboam's family. So God was punishing him for the wickedness that he did in following Jeroboam, but we can see right there that he specifically mentions the murdering of the family of Jeroboam was another reason that God punished him. It tells us then about Elah in verse 8. Pretty deep. We're over halfway into Asa's reign now when Elah becomes king of Israel, and he reigned over Israel in Tirzah 2 years. Now that's exactly like what it said about Nadab, the son of Jeroboam. Of course, what do we also know when it's saying 2 years here? Again, we're going to the method of counting that Israel used. In actuality, as far as if you want to take the count of the actual time that he reigned, that would have been a 1 year. So, but that the way they counted it, it came out as two because the accession to the throne counted as year one by their count. So just keeping that in mind again. But this is exactly what happened. Same length of time for the sons of these men. I mean, it's precisely what happened to Jeroboam and his family, what's going to happen to Baasha. So his son becomes king, reigns for that year. And then in verse 9, his servant Zimri, who was captain of half his chariots, conspired against him as he was in Tirzah. And what was he doing there? Drinking himself drunk in the house of Arza, the steward of his house in Tirzah. So here he is in the act of getting drunk, and his own servant, who was one of his military leaders there, very likely that Baasha served in a similar role. We don't have the details of that, but for him to be able to do what he did, that's typically the way things went. But in any event, he's very specific and tells us that Zimri was a captain of half of his chariots. Keep this in mind because a very notorious woman is going to bring up this exact event when she's going to be facing her death by Jehu, the son of Nimshi, who was Ahab's captain. And then he is the one that destroyed the house of Ahab. We're going to see that same pattern being carried out. And when he comes to the tower where Jezebel is, she's going to ask, well, did Zimri have peace when he conspired against his master and slew him? So she was going to bring up this very event that we're reading about. Jehu's response to that with Jezebel was to ask who was going to throw her down. I mean, they threw her out of the tower and splat she went, and then the dogs ate her, and there was nothing left but her. Remember that? That's a really graphic. The kids love this one, but you know, when there's just the soles of her feet and the palms of the hands and their little skull top left. I mean, there was not much. There were just a few scraps. That's all that was left of Jezebel, but she brought this situation up about Zimri, and was warning him because Zimri's not going to last long. But Jehu was a different case, as we'll see. But in any event, Zimri does this. He's Elah's captain, and so he conspired against him. So here he is, the king, getting drunk. Zimri came in and smote him and killed him. And it says in the 27th year of Asa's reign, which, what year did he begin his reign in verse 8? The 26th. So how much actual time has passed? 1 year. But again, it's counting by their count as two. This is exactly like chapter 15 with what happened with Nadab, Jeroboam's son. So as soon as he killed the king and he takes over, what does Zimri do? I mean, he wastes no time at all. I mean, he slew all of the house of Baasha. He didn't leave any of him remaining, and not even his friends. I mean, he wiped out everybody in the family or anybody, any potential ally there. And so he destroyed them all. Now, who was the one using Zimri to do that in verse 12? God was. Did that mean that God approved of what Zimri was doing here? No more so than he did with Baasha and what he did. And he gives his reason why. Verse 13, for all the sins of Baasha and the sins of Elah, his son, by which they sinned and by which they made Israel to sin. So even though, you remember with Nadab, even though he reigned a full year, he mentioned in chapter 15 that Nadab walked in the sins of his father, doing those evils and making Israel to sin. Was a year long enough for him to do something about that wickedness? Did he have an excuse to wait a year to start doing something about that problem? Could he be judged as innocent? Well, I've only been king a year. I mean, I'll get around. I'll start cleaning that. No. For 1 year, he was participating and carrying on the same actions that his father had done. Well, Baasha continued it. He dies, his son comes in, and even though it's only a year, he's guilty. Does God hold him accountable for that, even though it was not for a long time? He does. So he continued the evil. So, if we ever come into a situation, whatever it is, if God gives us some authority, whatever the application is, and if in whatever we're given authority, there's something wrong, and we have the authority, the ability, the opportunity to do something about something that's wrong, what should we do? And when should we do it?
It says, he that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, for him it's sin.
That's the last verse of James chapter 4. And that's right. So we're going to be held accountable by God if he gives us the opportunity to do something. And we all know Galatians 6:10, as we therefore have opportunity, we need to do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. Whenever the opportunity is there to do good in whatever way it is, we'd better do it, and to not do it is sin. So we have to take those opportunities, and we can't procrastinate that. We have the example, the great contrast. We remember David. Now, David had been chosen by God to be king of Israel long before the people came around to recognize what God had decided, and eventually he was anointed king over the tribe of Judah, and then later still, finally, all the tribes came together, anointed him to be king over them all. But what did David do as soon as he actually possessed the authority to, as king, to do whatever needed to be done in his nation? And he immediately first went to Jerusalem and drove the Jebusites out of that, and then took that city, because that was a command of God that had not yet been obeyed for all those centuries since they entered the land, that they let the Jebusites stay there. That was a city that was supposed to be part of Benjamin's inheritance. And Saul, who was of the tribe of Benjamin, that was king, did nothing about it. But as soon as David became king, that was the first thing he did in 2 Samuel 5, as he went right in there and drove the Jebusites out of Jerusalem, took it and made that the city of David. The very next thing he did was he remedied that situation where the Ark of the Covenant had been languishing. There was no tabernacle. The Ark of the Covenant was not in a proper place. So the next thing he did is he brought the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. Then the very next thing after that, he wanted to have a building for it, and he got God's approval to build the temple and spent the rest of his year reign collecting the materials and organizing for that. But we can see with David, as soon as he became king, he immediately started fixing whatever problems were there, as his heart was set to do the Lord's will in everything. There was no delay in that at all. In this case, of course, we see, even though the reigns were brief for Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, and now with Elah, the son of Baasha, they both continued in the sins of their predecessors, and God punished them for that. So then it says in verse 14 that the rest of his acts are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. Now, we're not going to have much to read about Zimri. We'll get to verse 15, Lord willing, next week. But he's going to have a whopping 7 days to reign as king. And I think there's only one method of counting 7 days. So there's not an alternative way to credit 7 days. That's 7 days. I mean, he's going to have a very brief reign, which is one reason why Jezebel brought that example up. But he's going to get punished real quick. But in fact, God's going to mention his evil. 7 days was enough time where he should have been already, if he was going to be righteous, that was enough time to start doing something good, but he didn't. But Lord willing, we'll get to that next week.